Yeah.
Okay.
National Guard was in the city of Wilmington.
It was in the city of Wilmington. The riot, we had the riots, the Martin Luther King murder had occurred. The National Guard was on the street and after the riots in Wilmington, and the governor never took the guard off. So Gene McGowan and I, black educator and I, chaired the Democrats for Peterson. We figured we may have gotten 1,000, worked downtown.
Yeah.
We maybe turned out 1,000 votes or so. And you remember it was a very close election. So that, of course, a lot of people thought they had done it.
Yeah.
Each of us thought we had done it.
Well, you did.
All together we did.
Right.
All together we did it.
Right.
Then Russ Peterson, when he came in as governor, first thing was, of course, then public accommodation, fair housing got passed promptly in his administration.
Yeah. You had a willing administrator.
Yeah, yeah. But governor came in with a concept of a line organization that he had grown up in the DuPont and reorganized the government and so that they established a Secretary of Human Resources or something of the sort. I forget exactly what it was. But at any rate, this secretary had one of several groups reporting to him. We reported to the secretary, no longer to the governor. Bye-bye, clout.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He lost it.
Yeah, yeah. And the commission is not, as you say, you haven't heard much of the commission.
No, either. No.
Yeah, and it may still be in existence, I'm not sure. But went through a number of chairs. Rabbi Grumbacher was chair for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But was never able to be as effective again.
Yeah. Well, that was a wonderful achievement, though, because you did.
Yeah.
It was during a time when, if you had not done that, it wouldn't have been done.
Yeah.
So you should be very proud of what you did.
Yeah, I guess it was after that that the DSEG, school DSEG came along.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was after
because
that.
You're talking now about Martin Luther King was killed in, what, 1968? And DSEG didn't get made an order until 78.
No, but in 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education.
Yeah, but in terms of dividing Wilmington up and
Right.
And at that point then, there was a Citizens Alliance for Public Education.
Right.
You remember, CAPE. And I was treasurer of that. And now I have to talk with a problem we have to deal with, and that is anger and anti-Semitism in the black community.
Which was emerging anew. Mm-hmm. It had not been as, before that, Jews were very cooperative, weren't they? The Jews and the blacks were working together for civil rights.
And the Jews continued to.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there was this undercurrent of hostility that, in a segment of the black community. I told you about an early one that was about 48 or so, this one woman who led off the names of the Jewish slumlords. And it was an inordinately high percentage of Jews involved in that thing, considering the number of Jews in town. And, this black anti-Semitism arose just as there's antipathy between the Puerto Rican and black communities, because they were fighting over the same turf at that time.
Yeah, but also, don't you think that there was the Black is Beautiful movement? There were lots of forces.
Yeah,
I don't
that's
know.
That's right. There were, and there were a lot of people becoming involved in political action, community action, who had never been involved before.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of people who suddenly realized they were angry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I think there were a lot of forces. But it is true. I think that was the seeds of the Black-Jewish rift.
Yeah.
Which occurred. So I do agree with that.
Yeah. And then, my own experiences with it, I told you the one. Another was actually on the commission. And went, drove down, went down to the commission meeting one time with a interested woman who said to me, Ben, and I, Ben, I went down to the butcher, what's his name?
In Wilmington,
yeah.
Second Street? Isaacs and Bat?
No, the Jewish butcher who
Russian background.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay.
Whatever his name
went
was.
Down to this to the butcher, and I went for a roast beef. I came back with a ham, and he was talking to me about the plight of the Jews in Russia. She said, I think we ought to do something about the commission ought to take a stand about anti-Semitism in Russia. Well, I didn't want to say no. I didn't really think it was particularly our role.
Mm.
But, okay, so she said, yeah. I said, yeah, go ahead. So she, at one point in the commission meeting, suggested this. The two black, leading black commissioners, I think there were more, but there were two leading black commissioners, were on their feet instantly saying that this was not a role for the commission.
And you were happy they did it?
My reaction was, yeah, they're right on the issue, but they didn't have to be so quick about it. Okay, you know, it was, and then on Citizens Alliance for Public Education, we were at steering committee meetings, and one of the black members at the time, I had asked, we were trying to get public participation, and I had called Nan Lipstein and asked her to line up people to join the caper, it was $5 or whatever it was, to join on. And after a week or two, I called Nan up and said, Shunga Nook, you're going to have the organization more than half Jewish. Okay.
That's too many.
Yeah.
Too many of us.
Yeah, at that point, the black committee members, I was treasurer, I was announcing the number of people who joined and paid. Said to me, how many shopkeepers are members?
Mm.
Well, BB, about a third.
Mm.
So there was always that kind of undercurrent. As a result, I kind of got out of particularly supporting the black community, and that's when I turned to taking a very active role
in the Jewish community.
The Jewish community.
Mm-hmm. So let's move on to what activities you were involved in the Jewish community.
Well, came back to town. I told you about the young adult division.
Right.
Came back to town. Sonny Schutzman asked me to join the budget committee of the JCC. And I spent a year at that and gave it up because I did not have the time to go through it, just as today, to try to understand the budget on you, as you know.
Glad to hear you say that.
So Sonny struggled with it.
No.
It was substantially impossible to know what the heck was going on.
No.
So I just got off that one. Okay. After that, we got more involved. I don't know any particular role. Maybe I did a little fundraising in Federation. But one day, Gil Spiegel called me up, and that was in 19, that would have been the spring of 73. Bennett, can I come over and talk to you and Alice? Surely. The year before, well, 2 years before, we had given $400. Okay. Sorry about that.
That made you a big giver.
Then the next year we raised it to $600. And that was not really a big gift. There were $5,000 gifts and $10,000 gifts. So this is not a big gift. But I guess more than people in our circumstances were doing with little kids at home. So Gil sat down in our living room, and I think at that point we were already at Hanover Road. This is, yeah, 73, sure, yeah. And remember, I remember the chair he sat in. And and he said, Brennan, I'm going to chair the next Federation Drive. I'd like you to be co-chair of the campaign. Come on, kiddo. Contributed $600. You know, how do I fit with all these multi-$1,000 contributors? And he said, well, you've been moving, you know, we've been watching, you've been moving up continually. And you gave $400 a couple years ago, $600 last year. If you will give $900 this year, you can be my co-chair. Okay, Gil will think about that. And Alice and I talked it over. And we decided, okay, we'll do that. And then, as you know, Gil got sick. And was out of the picture. And I was suddenly the acting chair. And then came the Yom Kippur War.
Mm.
And we were suddenly...
Right in the middle.
Right in the middle. And UJA said, okay, we'd like everybody to triple from last year. Okay. So I called the meeting. You know, obviously you discussed it with Alice. And some of the movers and shakers are there. And here am I. A young, much younger man, and a tiny contributor compared to these guys. And I said, okay, we're going from 600 to 1800, what are you going to do? And they came along various kinds of ways.
That was a very moving meeting, as I recall, that whole time.
Well, then there was the big meeting.
The big meeting.
Where people, you know, made massive contributions.
So you were the chairman of the... the campaign committee.
Yeah.
And then, after that, you became...
active field.
When did you become president of the Federation?
That's an interesting question.
Because you were involved throughout that whole period.
Yeah. Then I became chair on my own, I think it was 78, if I remember rightly. I was chair of the campaign then in 78, and I think I became president, and you know, those records, my pictures up on the wall, right, with all the other presidents, with the years. I think it was 79 or 80.
Uh-huh. You became...
For 2 years, yeah.
So you were president during that period.
Yeah, for a couple of years.
And so, since then, you've been in a variety of roles in the Federation and Jewish community.
Yeah.
Hillel.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, I always, it's always my friends who do it to me. Gil did it to me one time, and Sonny the next time.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, and Sonny said he was not in condition to
continue
anymore. And so I took over that.
So now it's your role to pass the mantle off.
Yes.
That's the way it is.
Yeah, oh yeah.
We all pass it on.
Oh yeah.
Before we pass on.
Before we pass on, right.
Hopefully.
Well, can you identify anything else we can talk about?
Well, you asked me about the general community.
Right.
Civil rights, for a while, there was a group called, go way back on civil rights. I was the representative of the Jewish community for a conference on religion and race. Mel Jewett, did you remember Mel?
Mm-hmm.
Who was the executive for the Council of Churches, had gotten this idea. And we put together, and he put together, a committee of three people. One, Tom Reese, Monsignor, then mm-hmm. Father Tom,
yeah, right.
And a man named Spencer Thompson, and Father Tom represented the Catholic community, I represent the Jewish community, and a man named Spencer Thompson, who was a vice president of Atlas at the time and chair, did the human relations work, chaired our committee, and we put together a big conference on religion and race down in Dover. And I think that predated can't remember, you know, I can't, nobody could remember the date. You'd have to go back through the journal's archives to dig it out.
Okay, but at least that meeting did take place.
The meeting did take place, and it was really sort of kind of a stepping stone.
For all of this?
For a lot of it.
Yeah. So you've been involved from the very beginning. We can call you the father of all of this.
Not quite, but, you know, certainly an active participant.
Yeah, but, you know, until you talk about it, you don't realize
the
what
scope,
kind of wide
yeah.
scope this that your role was, and so you need to, that's why it's necessary to put it together.
For a while I chaired, at least for 1 year or two, the Council of Churches had a 9th Ward division, included a number of churches, and I chaired that group of the 9th Ward, you know, north of the Brandywine, Hanover Presbyterian, and big, is it McCabe Methodist?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cathedral of St. John, and there are a number of other churches involved with that. And I chaired that for 1 year.
So the churches were involved in all of this.
I can remember.
Mm-hmm. Strongly involved.
Can remember now. I don't know whether it was in 73, or 67, but I think it was 73. And I was chair of that thing at the time. And I can remember a meeting when the Yom Kippur War started. And a meeting of a number of ministers in that area. And I asked them to stand and stay a memorial. Well, stay Kaddish, really. For all the people who were going to die in that conflict. Not a man moved.
Oh, really? Oh, heaven.
Basically, I was asking for support for Israel.
Oh, wow. No, that was...
Nobody moved.
That was off limits, wasn't it?
Yeah, nobody
moved. That's a very interesting story.
Yeah.
Well, we've come a long way
from
that time.
North Brandywine Council of Congregations is what it was called.
Okay. It takes a little while to get these names to come back.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I can see that you've been involved in a myriad of things, from certainly a lot of civil rights and a lot of identification with the Jewish causes of the time. So they all sort of merged.
Which led to the civil rights.
Right.
We got involved through Torah, basically.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Talking about that, what your interest in studying Jewish Torah has been more intense than many people. What do you think motivated you, or some of the causes? Because you've studied a great deal.
Whatever it was that made me a Columbia student without any background or very intensive training to go to those little meetings of the Jewish student group on that campus.
So you've been studying all your life?
No, I wasn't studying them, but I'd go to an occasional meeting. But I just had the feeling of involvement in life as a Jew. That's all.
And spirituality.
Yes. Yeah.
So,
watch the TV series, telco series on cosmology, and know where my interests come from. Okay.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Well,
Lord hung the moon and the sun, and the sun out there.
I'm very impressed with the broad spectrum of all the things you've done. Unless you can tell me more on behalf of the Jewish community, I say thank you for. For everything you've done.
Yeah. Time to talk about what Alice has been doing.
Alice?
The only thing I'd like to add to that is that there were three sons along the way.
I know.
Yeah.
We'll talk about the three sons.
The three sons, and to talk about all the things you've done.
First, let's talk about your background.
Yeah.
Because Ben mentioned Norwalk, Connecticut. Is that where you were born?
No. I was born in New York City in Lenox Hill Hospital in 1931. And neither of my parents were immigrants, and none of my Only one of my grandparents was an immigrant. His family
had... Did you come over on the Mayflower?
Practically. They came over in the 1850s, approximately. And one of my, whatever, great-great-great-uncles, whatever, made an invention, and we still have the patent for it, of a dickie that went over a man's shirt so that the man didn't have to change his shirt, he could only change the dickie. And he made so much money on this that my grandfather, who was the only immigrant in the bunch, came over to this country first class.
Oh, wow.
So nobody in my family stopped at Ellis Island.
Oh, wow.
And my mother's side of the family was in the import business. They imported olives and I don't remember what else, but that sort of food goods. My father's father, no, my father's grandfather was an immigrant from Germany. All of my family came from Germany, both sides. And he started out as a peddler in the Catskills and made enough money doing that that his son went to College of Physicians and Surgeons and became a doctor. And he married supposedly a beautiful, this is my father's mother, parents, a beautiful woman who had three girls and then a boy who was my father, the last, and considerably younger than the three daughters. And when my grandmother was, when my father was, my mother couldn't remember, was six or nine, she died very suddenly, and people now think it was botulism.
Oh, wow.
In
how
spite
old was
of
she?
The, she was, I don't know, youngish,
yeah,
certainly under 40, and married to a doctor, but there was nothing to be done. Leaving my father in the charge of his three older sisters and a Fräulein. My guess...
So they were German.
Oh, were they German? And
you didn't mention that.
Yeah, they all came from Germany. And my guess is that my father's father was so shocked and grief-stricken by this that he may well have ignored his family and particularly his little boy.
Mm.
Made sure that they were taken care of in terms of the Fräulein taking
right.
care of them and all. But it left my father very angry and embittered.
Mm.
And he spent the rest of his life being angry at his father. However, his father remarried when my father was something like 11 to a very lovely woman who my father came to love.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a nice side of his family. My both of my parents grew up in New York City of well enough to do families that they both went to summer camp and both went to New York City public schools. My mother went to Hunter College High School, which was a very special school in those days, I think for girls, and then went on to get a college degree at NYU, where I think she majored in hat making or something, but it wasn't much that she majored in. And my father left school at the age of 14, never went back. Again, partly in anger at his own father, joined the Navy in anger because the Germans had torpedoed the Lusitania, which was at that point supposed to be an unarmed passenger ship. And of course, later they found that the Lusitania was carrying munitions.
Hell, man.
But at any rate, my father was in the Navy for a short period of time.
During World War I.
Right. And my parents married in 1925, I think. And my sister was born in 1926. No, they didn't marry in 25. They married in 28. Let me go back a ways to my mother. After my mother graduated from college, her parents, who were, I think, pretty remarkable people, and I only knew my grandfather, but she and another woman who she had only met once before in her life went on a 3-month tour of Europe together, alone together, with letters of credit all over Europe, and did things like flying in an open airplane above the Danube River to get from one place.
She must have been a very
intrepid,
ahead of her time.
A long way ahead of her time. And so was the other woman she went with, who was among the first graduates of Yale Law School and later went on to be a lawyer in New York City. At any rate, they had the time of their lives and had a lot of tales to tell, but it was very unusual. It was unusual for the parents to allow them to go. My Italian isn't great. They went to someplace in Italy, and the mattress was very lumpy. So they called down to the desk, and what I remember from my mother's story, and my Italian may be wrong, is that they ordered a Harisha Matrosa, asking for a hair mattress, but whatever the Italian was, what they asked for was a hairy sailor.
Did they
so I don't think they got it. And she also had stories about having lunch in a lovely little restaurant someplace in Holland, which turned out to be a whorehouse. So they were two very intrepid, innocent young people, at the same time as the Cornelia Otis Skinner, Our Hearts Were Young and Gay story. It was the same kind of time. Anyway, she came back and she married my father. My sister was born in 1930. It's an unfortunate strain, a genetic strain in my family, and I'm sure that's what it is, that all of the women on that side of the family end up with breast cancer.
Mm.
So my mother's grandmother died of breast cancer, but at a quite ripe old age. She had celebrated her 50th wedding anniversary. But her daughter, my mother's mother, knew she had something wrong, and the doctor said, it's nothing, until finally it was too late. And so she died quite young. I guess her mid-30s, something like that, of breast cancer. And then just to go on with it, my mother had breast cancer in her late 30s, but was operated on successfully and lived to be 91. And both my sister and I have since had it, so it's... But just the strain that runs through the family is sort of an undercurrent of all of the women in the family. At any rate, my sister was born in New York City, and then I was born in New York City, and my parents were not well-to-do, but certainly had enough, and my sister and I attended the Ethical Culture Schools. And the reason we did was because my parents were very active members of the Society for Ethical Culture, as was my grandfather, in spite of the fact that his father had been a rabbi.
Mm.
But it was during a period when the rabbis were quite strict, the German rabbis particularly, then the offspring broke away from it.
Yeah, it was the emergence of ethical culture at that time, and
my father particularly was a devoutly ethical man. It was his badge of honor to do things that were correct and the right thing to do, and he was.
So he probably approved of Ben and all his.
Well, he did. And he didn't.
Ambivalent, yeah.
Yes. He approved of what Ben was doing. But along with being very ethical,
He was also something of an anti-Semite.
Oh.
And he was not thrilled that I was marrying a practicing Jew.
But...
He was also very proud of my DuPont car.
Oh, yes, yeah. Extremely yeah. proud, yeah. right. He was proud of everything Ben did, except for being Jewish, and that was something he had to swallow. What?
Can I tell the chicken coop story?
Sure.
I guess we had been very shortly married, or even me before, it was about that time, and it was a hot summer day, and he and Alice's mother were ardent gardeners, and he had found a marvelous case of chicken manure in some unused chicken coop, and he asked me to go out and dig it out with him. So there we were, you know, a hot, stifling day in this, you know, low ceiling, on our hands and knees, digging this stuff out, both, you know, covered with sweat and smell, and I think it did improve our relationship.
Probably,
it was a
yeah.
true test.
Right,
oh,
that's
yeah.
right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Ben married
well,
me
what,
anyway.
What was it, Jay Jacobs?
They were right.
Yeah, right.
Tale, yeah.
So, in 1937, I think, my parents bought a house in Norwalk, Connecticut, which was where we went as a family for all summers and for many weekends in the spring and fall. And then finally in 1953, my parents moved up there permanently as their permanent residence. But I was basically raised in New York City, and it was a different New York City than there is now. It was my backyard. In high school, I went to high school on the subway, and we wandered the streets at night. There
felt
was
perfectly safe.
Perfectly safe. I have a number of canaries buried in Central Park, and you know, it was just
yeah.
we roller skated on the sidewalks and bicycled on the sidewalks and knocking over who knows who, and New York was where I was, but it was also a great benefit because my friends and I would go to the museums. My father took me to the planetarium. We lived a block and a half from the Museum of Natural History. And we went to the planetarium once a month. You'd think I'd know something about the stars, but I don't. And
sounds like heaven to me.
It was, you know, we go to the Museum of Modern Art. We wander
yeah.
all over. It
yeah.
was, the world was our oyster at that point.
And then it was time to go to school.
I went to grade school in the Midtown School, which was Ethnic and Cultural School at 66th and Central Park West. And then I went to junior high and high school in Fieldson School, which is in Riverdale in the Bronx. Graduated in 1949. I was sort of on the outs in Fieldson. I think all high school students feel they're on the outs anyway. But because there were many students there who were Jewish, and I was not affiliated and didn't really consider myself Jewish.
So they didn't
at
think
that
you were
point.
Part of the group.
Right, I was sort of in the offbeat group, the folk singing, whatever, you know, outing club, whatever group. And I was not in the in group. And it could be I just felt I wasn't because in high school kids don't, I don't know.
Right.
Well, also a lot of rich kids.
And yeah, they were very rich, I remember.
It was a private school.
It was a private school and...
Well, just the fact that you went to a private school.
Yes, right.
Put you in a different category.
I remember visiting one friend whose parents lived on Park Avenue, and they had 7 bathrooms in this apartment on Park Avenue, and I was so impressed. I thought that would be really handy in case of need, but... But that's what some of my friends were, and we didn't live like that. We we had a much more
modest
apartment.
And so then when you graduated, you went to college?
I went to Simmons College. But first, for one of my graduation requirements, I had to do community service. Everybody did. And I think that, for me, was part of the beginning of it. The other two that had three things in summers that had an influence. In 1945, I think, I went to an American Friends Service Committee work camp outside of New Haven, where we were helping a neighborhood community put together a summer camp for their kids. And we lived, there were about, I don't know, 20 of us, boys and girls, teenagers, and we lived in tents and worked for the summer to help put together this camp. And we worked with many of the neighborhood kids.
And how did that influence it?
I sort of saw how other parts of the world lived.
And how about your other experience?
The next summer, I took a 9,000 trip. My parents inherited something from their parents. A 9,000 trip, mile trip across Canada, down the West Coast, the Southwest, and then coming up north with the American Youth Hostel. Mm. We traveled most of it by train, and then when we got to some place, we would bike around. And it was a fascinating trip and certainly opened my eyes to the world. Now, most of the other kids on that trip were much more like myself. In fact, many, many of them were Jewish. But in terms of the places we went to, we drove the Banff, we biked the Banff Jasper Highway when it was a dirt road with little camping stops along the way.
Wow.
And then the following summer, and this was the third summer,
I've seen pictures of Alice
yeah.
in those days. Boy, was she skinny.
I was. Not only skinny, but the only clothes or anything we could bring with us was what we could fit into two saddlebags on the side of the bicycles.
Well, wow.
When I got home, my mother said she burned the clothes. She had never seen anything so dirty in her life. Anyway, the following summer, I was with the Unitarian Service Committee in a work camp in the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee. And that opened my eyes to, first of all, the black-white prejudice, which I had never really seen before in New York City. Of course, it was there, but I was living in a very secluded community.
Yeah.
And secondly, opened my eyes to unions and the power of unions, because the folk school was to support union leadership,
mm-hmm.
to train leaders.
Well, I can see
leadership.
Why you two made music together.
Yeah.
What's also interesting is that Stephen, our middle son's wife, also spent time at the Highlander Folk School a generation later.
So she was indoctrinated also.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, they were real influences in my life in terms of seeing how other people lived and recognizing my place in the world in terms of other people who were not so fortunate, recognizing how fortunate I was. I went to Simmons College and majored in psychology and early childhood development. And after college, my father said to me, "I will pay your airfare any place you want to go in the United States if you get a job there." So, of course, I chose San Francisco.
I would do the same thing.
And I worked in nursery school in San Francisco and then did clerical work to help out for a year. And while I was there, I applied to Harvard Graduate School of Education, because I realized I wanted to end up in education, but I knew that I could not spend my life in preschool education, partly because it was so physically demanding. I knew that at some point my back would give out with those kids jumping on my back. So I graduated from Harvard Graduate School of Education in 55 with a master's degree in elementary education. That was the year that Ben and I met, and we were very rich in those days. One of us had a salary. I taught in Lincoln, Massachusetts, and I earned $3,200 for the year with a master's degree.
Well, honey, I was making $100 a month.
Right. The first winter we were married, it snowed every Saturday. Every Saturday, 12 inches of snow. And we were so poor, we had one pair of boots between us, and we had the same size feet.
So only one of us.
Two feet could go out.
Two feet could go out,
or when somebody got their feet wet. Yeah. Anyway. And I got pregnant with David 4 months after we were married.
From the snow.
From the snow, no. And by then, Ben had gotten his PhD, and that's when we were looking at jobs. That's when my pearls broke in the ladies' room. And we ended up back in Wilmington then.
How did you feel about Wilmington after New York City?
Well, it wasn't so much after New York City. It was, because I hadn't really lived in New York City for 6 years. But I knew nobody. Mm-hmm. Ben knew all these people. And I didn't know a soul. We lived in Monroe Park, which was great because there were some people I could meet. Mm-hmm. Herman and Mitzi Rosenblum lived across the hall from us, and Mitzi was pregnant with Ellen at the same time, and that was a great help. And, you know, met a few people, but I just felt very much alone. Ben was all by himself, and I didn't have any child to take care of. Ben wasn't, David wasn't born until January, and we got here in September. And it was, you know, sort of
lonesome. Yeah.
But, you know, I made some friends. Mm. And then David was born, and Stephen was on the way, and we knew that Monroe Park and its one-bedroom apartment was a little tight for us, and we looked for a house, and I'm trying to think. It was before Stephen was born, I think, we moved into a house in Shelburne, where we lived for 7 years.
No, we only lived in Monroe Park for a year.
1 year in Monroe Park, right. And during this period, Ben had one friend in DuPont, Manny Ziegler, whose wife...
Marge,
thank you. We had made friends with. And Marge said, why don't you join National Council of Jewish Women, and I think you'll meet some people you like. And that was really my introduction to getting to know anybody.
In the community.
It was through National Council of Jewish Women, mm-hmm. and I, for the next, I don't know how many years, I was very active, mm-hmm. and I did... After the two boys were born, I did volunteer work 2 days a week or 2 afternoons a week, and worked on the board and got as far as community vice president or community services vice president, whatever it was. Anyway, and worked with National Council. First, I worked in a program they had helping the staff in family court, and that's quite different from the domestic violence program. We had nothing to do with that, but it introduced me to some of the ins and outs of domestic violence. I remember being shocked at some of the husbands and wives who were in court facing each other but sitting in the waiting room chatting and laughing together. I just didn't understand it. But at any rate, it introduced me to some of that, and I worked on that for a while. And then the council started a program at the Woodhaven Cruz School for delinquent girls. And then I was getting back into education, and I worked there as a volunteer for many years. And Eric was born in 1964, and that was the same year we moved to the house in North Hills. And I guess a couple of years after Eric was born, I was still doing volunteer work, but then I wanted to get a part-time job in education. And the only part-time job I could get was at Woodhaven. And I spent 3 years at Woodhaven teaching reading. And it was a very difficult job.
Woodhaven was a school for...
Adolescent delinquent girls.
Delinquent girls.
And they were angry girls, and they were upset, and they were... And the kids would be sent there for things that we would never send them anymore. For truancy, they'd be sent away, you know, this sort of thing. And really what they needed was a lot of family counseling, mm-hmm. but at any rate, nobody knew that in those days, or they didn't put money into it. And so they were sent to Woodhaven, and living in an institutional environment, and it was really pretty bad. And some of the girls had a lot of drug problems. I remember one kid who, what do they call it when she had a flashback? in my classroom, and everything flew. I mean, she was yelling and screaming, and the books were flying, and et cetera. And I had some very difficult girls, and some very nice girls who probably came out of it and worked out their problems, but some of them were really, you know, very violent and difficult kids to work with. But it was the only thing I could get. And
part-time.
Part-time.
Right.
Right. And then I applied for a full-time job. By this time, Eric was going into first grade, with the Wilmington Public Schools. And this was before DSAG in the early 70s. And got a job as a reading teacher with Wilmington Public Schools.
So that got you into the reading program.
And that got me into the reading program. Now, in the late 60s, I knew that I wanted to do reading, that I wanted to specialize. And I went back to the University of Delaware. I already had my master's, but I needed certification courses in reading. And I spent, I think it was 3 years, taking one course at a time with Dr. Pikulski, Dr. Stauffer, who taught me everything I needed to know and gave me a headache.
He had a reading.
Right, the Reading Study Center, right.
Right, at
right.
The university.
And he was just an impossible person to work with, but taught me an awful lot. Mm. And I worked at the Reading Study Center with a child and got experience with that. So I had my credentials when I applied for Woodshaven, but it was the only place I could go. And then when I was willing to work full-time, when Eric went to first grade, then I went to Wilmington Public Schools and worked there as a what they call a reading resource teacher, which was going into the classroom and helping the teachers with reading program.
And you excelled at that, obviously, because
I learned a lot. I learned a lot on the job.
Yeah.
I mean, you do, you know.
And how long did you work City of the Wilmington?
I'm trying to count back. It was probably 4 years.
Until it became